This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, invite language over the threshold. Today's episode is all about language matters in the television show Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Yes, a version of this episode originally appeared on the podcast Buffering the Vampire Slayer. Doesn't matter if you haven't seen the TV show, and at the time of recording I'd only seen a handful of episodes, because this Buffallusionist special is packed full of the etymological goods: vampires, covens, military slang, spooky Latin, wigs, and liquid beef. Many thanks to Buffering the Vampire Slayer for getting me on to face their listeners' language questions with hosts Kristen Russo and Jenny Owen Youngs, who is also my co-host on my other podcast, VMI. And you'll remember her from this show a couple of years ago. She co-wrote and performed our festive hit for 2020, which was a lovely episode. It's not really the season to listen to that one at the moment, but, well, I'm already being deluged with online ads for luxury advent calendars, so maybe this season is fine. Yeah, do it. Yeah, listen to this episode first, though. There are some swears on this episode. Just to quickly mention that there is one show left on the Your Name Here live tour of Aotearoa New Zealand at the Auckland Writers' Festival on the 27th of August 2022. Get your tickets via theallusionist.org/events. On with the show.
Hello, and welcome to a very special episode of Buffering the Vampire Slayer, a podcast where we're usually talking about Buffy one episode at a time, but today we are breaking out the linguistic microscope with a very special guest to examine elements of language in the show. Please welcome my friend and Kristen's less close friend. Helen Zaltzman.
It makes it sound like Kristen and I have got beef.
I know, but it does. It makes it sound like we used to be close, but then like something came between us, betwixt us.
Yeah, but the truth is we just haven't spent enough time together yet to get to the point where we have beef.
We have a lot of questions for you.
Well, I love to answer lots of questions.
Well, we're going to start at what I felt would be a good beginning place, which was a question from Alicia. Why is Buffy named Buffy? I've heard it short for Elizabeth, which sounds odd to my ears, but is there any kind of linguistics history around why the name or nickname Buffy would be chosen for a vampire slaying heroine? When I first saw the show, it threw me off, especially as no one really comments on her name being unusual.
Well, there's not linguistics history so much as there is Joss Whedon history. He was asked about it in an interview, I think 2003. And he said, it was the name that I could think of that I took the least seriously. There is no way you could hear the name Buffy and think this is an important person. To juxtapose that with Vampire Slayer just felt like that kind of thing, a B-movie. But a B-movie that had something more going on. That was my dream.
That's like the kind of stuff I had in my head as well, that like the name was picked to specifically turn, you know, the idea of a tiny blonde girl in the alley who could kick your ass on its head. So why not pick a name, right, like you said, that you would take the least seriously?
It's a name you can imagine someone giving their cat and you wouldn't think that odd. But yeah, I had seen some people speculating that he named her after Buffy St. Marie, the Canadian musician. Buffy St. Marie would be a cool name icon, but I hadn't seen Joss Whedon confirm it. And apparently the network really hated the title. And he refused to change it.
Yeah, stuff it, network.
Yeah.
Exactly. But I wonder how many people with the full name Elizabeth there are.
How the hell do you get from Elizabeth to Buffy?
Oh, people are wild, Kristen, with names like Peggy being short for Margaret. How do they get there?
What?
Molly being short for Mary, which it's not
short.
Any shorter than.
That's an extra letter.
People go a lot of places with Mary. Also, the Elizabeth means Sabbath. So that's interesting as well, to think like Buffy means
on the
something as religious as that.
Well, I mean, it's such a Christian.
Always wearing a cross.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually kind of cool, maybe unintentional, but because there is such a rootedness around the Hellmouth, and there's a lot of Christian shit in this show, as we have talked about a few times.
That is true. Not so much Jewish shit, though.
No, as a matter of fact, like the exact opposite, because Willow is Jewish. In the fact that she says she is Jewish and mentions it like two to three times, you know, in the series. And it's kind of not spoken about. But it's really interesting when, I mean, for a million reasons. But one is that, like, she's on a hellmouth and, like, there is no hell
It's just a mouth.
Right, it's just a mouth.
Just a sinkhole.
This question is from Imogen in Oxford. Unclear whether it's Lyra's Oxford, Will's Oxford, or somebody else's Oxford. Imogen says, in Restless, Dream Riley keeps calling Buffy killer instead of slayer, much to her confusion. This is a theme that comes up a few times, e.g. Faith in Who Are You affirming that she's not a killer, she's a slayer. Is there any linguistic or etymological distinction between these terms? What's the history of both of them? In other contexts, I feel like they're used pretty interchangeably, but in the show, a distinction is drawn and becomes quite a defining trait for slayer identity.
What other context is slayer used? I don't feel like they're used that interchangeably in my life.
You distinguish between when you're killing and when you're slaying, Helen.
Absolutely.
Okay. It's important.
Absolutely. I was interested to find that both of them originally meant to injure someone, just not fatally, and then...
And then things got out of hand.
So I think slayer was an earlier word than killer, and kill came from like an old English word, quellan, which is like the word quell, which is much gentler than kill, even though it's kind of subtly different. There's a noun, slay, that means an instrument on a weaver's loom to beat up the weft, which is from the same root because it means to strike. And there's a last name, slaymaker, who is someone who makes slays, as in slays for the weaving.
For the weaving.
Incredible.
Whoa, cool.
Yeah.
Wow.
But I think in Buffy's case, she favours slayer over killer because killer is generic, right? There's all sorts of people who are killers. Slayer is a calling. Slayer is kind of noble in that she sacrificed her life for doing that. Killer is any old murderer, you know, or exterminator.
Yeah, it does. It feels more like common. You know, anybody can do it. But is that, like, I, in my own mind, you know, I can't really separate it from the fact that I probably came to the word slayer via Buffy the Vampire Slayer, you know?
Yeah. And that's funny, isn't it? Because I don't think any of us would puzzle out what that means if we'd never heard the word slayer before. Mm. But I don't know that. Well, I suppose I'd heard of the band Slayer.
Right.
But that's still marginal, isn't it? It's not in my daily vocabulary.
Ian from Cloudy Scotland asked, why is Latin still associated with spooky things?
That's a really...
Well, it's a dead language, Kristen.
Yeah, it's a ghost language that just won't die. I think because it is a language of religion, like it was the official language of Catholicism until really recently, I think until the 1960s. And not only that, it was also the language of science. And for a long time, there was so much more crossover with what we would now separate into like magic or occult and science than there is now. So broadly, I'd say that was it. And then you had like a lot of things that, yeah, were scientific then, like alchemy, where people were just trying it. And now you would think, well, that's some crank stuff.
Hality. Crazy until it works.
Yeah,
right, exactly. So I think that was another thing. People were intoning this stuff in quite serious and boomy and repetitive ways. And if you associate Latin with that, then it's not much of a leap to be like, okay, we'll use that because people automatically feel the kind of thing where it's like familiar but unfamiliar. It feels historical and elevated and mysterious but comprehensible enough just because if you speak a language derived from it, you're like, oh, that word sounds a bit like this.
Mm. Right, right.
But Latin is very privileged. It's got all this respect and this global botanical and scientific impact, then you're like, why did you get it? Just, you know, the Roman Empire fell in what, 450 AD? Yeah, Latin's still going great for a dead thing.
Going strong. Like, even being dead cannot stop it from pervading.
Because people just keep perpetuating it. You know, I'll just take the Latin out for one last dance.
Yeah, and it's never the last dance.
Never. Just keeps on dancing.
All right, coming in from Barbados, this question is from Khalil, who asks, what is the origin of the word coven? Did it always mean witches?
I love that.
No, it has the same root as convent, and that's what it meant for men as well. And it is basically like, you know, the word convene. Mm. It's the same word as that, like it's a coming together or like an assembly, so people gathering. And I guess a convent was where people gathered to do religious observance.
Wow.
And then it became witchy in the 1660s, probably. I don't know whether that was just like a particularly hot time for witch gathering. When was like, I would have thought the big times for witch burnings were a bit earlier than that, but maybe that was one-off witches rather than covens.
Well, when was the big plague?
The big one?
Oh, well, there are a few big plagues, but there was one that ended in 1666, so...
Also, because isn't that the plague? But isn't that the plague where we got the root of alewives from? Because alewives were making beer, which people could drink without getting sick because they were boiling the water, but they didn't like connect the fact that it was the boiling of the water that made them able to drink the beer. So people were drinking a lot of beer and alewives were making a lot of beer, and then they were making money on their own and they didn't need husbands. And then they were defamed by, you know, the Catholic Church, because the Catholic Church didn't want women making their own money. And that's where they got branded as witches. And
single independent women.
So, and I don't know if it's, I don't know if I have the right plague, but I do know that, like, if I do, then that would make a lot of sense for Coven to also be pivoting around that time. Because it was really when, like, the idea of a witch was kind of first branded, almost literally kind of branded, like marketed.
It was popularized by an earlier plague in the 1300s. And actually by the 1600s, the men had managed to come in and like seize the brewing industry and start pushing out the alewives. Fuck's sake. So I don't know as much to do with witches. There was a lot of like religious turmoil that may have resulted in people being like, you know what, let's take it out on the witches again. It's always an easy win. But the term... like, even though it had been around for witches since about 1660, it didn't really take off until the 1920s when the anthropologist and folklorist Margaret Murray popularized this idea of witches gathering in covens of 13 people as a sort of witchy analog of Christ and the 12 disciples. But this theory is like widely discredited. And then someone else was like, well, it might just have been that 13 was a convenient number to fit in a 9-foot coven house. I don't know where they get this shit from, honestly. I think witch history and science is not necessarily built on the most solid foundations, you know?
You have to really raise at least one eyebrow at how much connective tissue there is between Christianity and these concepts of magic and witches and covens. And, you know, like, they just always seem to be together.
Yeah, it's like, it's they almost as if the church doth protest too much, methinks.
The Wile E. Coyote to Witches Roadrunner.
Yeah. Mary Megan from Connecticut said, I'm really curious about the etymology of 90s slang wigging. In Buffy, we hear characters say, gives me the wiggins, wiggy and wiggin' out. Excuse me for paraphrasing. Where does this come from?
Wigging out, you say it's 90s slang. It's not, it's 1950s slang.
Wow.
And it was probably like saying to flip your wig. If you're wigging out, you're in such a state of agitation that your wig is dislodged. And I think that kind of slang has actually been around for like way longer, I guess, because like wig wearing was associated with fancy people of the past. And like if you had a really tall wig, it was like such a status symbol. The taller, the better for the more power. So like that's why you had big wig as well. Like if you had a big wig, you were... an important one. But also like wig was used as like an analogy for the human head, which hair is often as well. Like the word poll, like when you go to vote, it was because they would counting people doing a head count, but they would say hair instead of head count. So I think wig was similar. And then you had a lot of like early 20th century African-American slang, which is where I think the whole flip one's wig came from and lots of other things. A wig picker was a psychiatrist.
So wig really was just like a shorthand in a lot of cases for your head.
And then Wiggins, that's a Joss Whedonism, and to be fair to him, don't love to give him credit, but that is a convincing sounding slang to come up with, I guess, because wig was already in people's vocabularies and it's quite a funny sounding word. Wiggins gives me the Wiggins.
Yeah.
down.
Yeah, he did a lot of like pluralizing, right, of things, and like adding S's to the ends and changing the like form of words for comedy, and just like to kind of create not a his own language, but kind of like one step maybe below that.
Yeah, that's pretty smart, isn't it? Take something familiar and just modify it enough that it seems particular to this.
Yeah. Which I feel like is what, I mean, like, I remember being in high school and, like, playing with words like that as well. Like, yeah, you know, like, sort of hearing it done to some other word and then taking that and applying it to something else. And that, you know, that was my experience growing up. So I'm sure that it happens totally. when you're of an age where you're sort of, like, familiar with your language enough to play with it.
Yeah. I think it's a very human impulse, isn't it, to get creative with it? You've got a lot of opportunities since you have to use it all the time. Do you think his original phrase was, "Gives me the Whedons"?
We can change it to that now.
This kind of connects nicely to a kind of similar email from Emma, who wrote in to say, Buffering the Vampire Slayer is credited as being the first time Google was used as a verb when, in season 7, episode 4, Willow asked Buffy, "Have you Googled her yet?" I'd love to hear your thoughts on pop culture verbifying nouns into actions.
That's a human thing again. This is a form of language play that is, people get so pissed off about it and they think it's newfangled, but it's been going on for as long as the English language has been going on. I think the truth of it wasn't that this was the first time Google had ever been used as a verb, but it may have been the first time Google was used as a verb on television.
Yeah.
Because this was 2002, and I think it had already been used as a verb by 2000. But Google were really pissed off about being used as a verb. And you'd think most brands would be like pretty thrilled to get to be the generic term for something, because it does mean that they have wiped the floor with the competition, and even if the company dies for whatever reason, they're going to be remembered. But they did this blog post in 2006 with lawyers saying which ways were acceptable to use the word Google and which weren't. So it's basically a passive-aggressive request for people not to use it as a verb, because they only wanted you to say Google if you actually meant using Google.
Boo. Shut up, Google.
What?
Sad sex.
Imagine Kleenex was like, could you actually only call our tissues Kleenex? Like, what would the basis be of, right? I mean, it's just like, if you're popularized that much, how could that be bad?
Yeah, weird. Well, it'd be terrible for the other manufacturers of tissues, but not for Kleenex. I mean, lucky them.
Right. Like, if some other brand of tissue was like, actually, you cannot use Kleenex to describe our tissues, that would make sense. But wow, that's fascinating.
But you can't control these things. Once they're out, people are going to use it how they want. And your blog post is not going to change that. Also, the word Google as a verb had been around actually since the early 20th century as a cricket term, which I'm sure you well across.
Oh, yeah, of course. Wait, what does it mean in cricket?
Oh, I don't give a shit. Some kind of ball thing from a googly shot. I grew up with a lot of cricket in the house, and I refuse to understand what a googly actually is. It's my form of rebelling against my childhood.
Let's take a little detour over to Faith, because I want to know what you think about this, but so did Bridget from South London, who asked, what is Helen's take on Faith's catchphrase, 5x5? We've done a lot of talking about this in the podcast space. So what do you think, Helen?
Have you covered where it's from?
We've covered various places where it might be from, but then the one I think we landed the most, that stuck the most, was Truckers Over the Radio, right? Was that kind of where we landed, Jenny?
Or did it have something to do with sailing?
See, so this is
Helen, help us.
Yeah, it is like a radio communications thing, apparently from the US military in the 1940s, and the 5-point scale they had for clarity and signal strength. So 5x5 was like top marks for both those things. So it just means I understand you perfectly. Fine. My take is, where did late 90s teen Faith get hold of this?
Faith's story could have easily included hitchhiking and grabbing rides with truckers. Can't you see Faith like getting down to Sunnydale?
That's true. Or maybe she spent a lot of time in childhood with World War II vets, or she watched Aliens a lot. Apparently they use it in Aliens.
Yeah, they do use it in Aliens.
And Alias. I don't think this show is too bad for it, but a lot of teen dramas, you're just so conscious that the writers are 30 plus years older than the characters and have not taken account of that. And maybe it would be more embarrassing if they were trying to be, how you doing, fellow kids? But you could maybe hire some young writers or do what Clueless did, which is like invent a whole system of convincing sounding slang that isn't real and therefore it doesn't get embarrassing. But it's like in the Gilmore Girls where like Rory Gilmore has like no references from art or media of her lifetime. So with Faith, like, I don't think it's as bad as that, but it still seems tenuous to me.
Yeah. Faith is somebody who specifically comes in with a different set of words from like her background and where she's coming from and seems to play with them a lot as well.
But she's not explicitly a time traveler or anything. She's not done a quantum leap.
She's not.
Not that we're aware
of. She's really not. And you made me think of the creator of My So-Called Life when you were talking about that, who I remember reading a lot about, how she sat and talked with them constantly. And the cast was notably mostly like 14, 15.
Yeah.
They were actually young high school students. And so that show, to me at least, stands apart as one where the way they talk was exactly how I talked when I was in high school in the 90s.
Yes, agreed. I think that was the first time that I was really conscious of people saying like in the way that now I use it all the time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
But I guess on TV before, it just wasn't really written like people actually speak.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go to Kavi's question. Kavi wrote in from California, and this goes back to the beginning of the show. Why does Giles's book from episode one have vampire spelled like that? I hope that I communicated the spelling to you by my pronunciation, listeners. Is that like an older spelling of vampire? Is it just dramatic flair? I don't think I've ever questioned it before, but now I'm dying to know.
Oh, please don't die. It's a vampire with a Y.
Indeed.
Yes. Was pretty interchangeable with vampire with an I when it first landed in English. Actually, I think the first appearance in English was with a Y. We probably got it from French or German, but it was based on, it's a little unclear, but it was based on Hungarian possibly or Slavic languages. And it was because at the time they were doing a lot of coverage of the Serbian vampire epidemic of 1725 to 1732.
Oh, of course.
Apparently there were a lot of Eastern European vampire epidemics.
What is a vampire epidemic?
I assume an epidemic of vampires. Imagine COVID, but for vampirism. And no vaccine. No masking is going to save
you. We have a new variant. And like Spike puts on his leather coat.
Makes people kind of sexy and nocturnal. I'd imagine there was like they were probably dying of some blood disease they blamed it on vampirism. But like they'd been writing about vampire-like creatures in English for hundreds of years before that. So the concept wasn't new. They just didn't really have the word in writing. Maybe it was too powerful to put in writing. I don't know. But like when it did appear in writing, it wasn't that people felt the need to explain it, which suggests that people already knew what a vampire was.
Interesting. Mm.
So anyway, with the Y, I imagine that it was partly because like spelling was a lot more flexible then. It wasn't really standardized and it had come from foreign languages. So that was another element of like, which is it? I don't know, just go with the flow. And then in the show, they're just going to choose whatever looks the most arcane, aren't they?
Yes.
Like they would use a long S if that was relevant.
V like it's supposed to be an old book. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this question came in from Kat, who says, thoughts on the recent prevalence of conlanging? How do you say that word, Helen?
Yeah, conlanging. Conlang is like a shortening of constructed languages. So languages that have been
conlanging.
Invented recently, and then conlanging is that in action.
Great. Okay, so I'm glad I stopped there because I needed to know what that word even meant.
Very
we went
fair
further.
Question.
Thoughts on the recent prevalence of conlanging in fantasy versus just making shit up as you need it versus using a real human language that's unlikely to be understood by the viewer. Going on David J. Peterson's Wikipedia, there's a lot of conlangs he's made for TV and film that were only used for one line or a couple of names. And to me, that seems like an awful lot of effort. But when
to you,
you
it does, but to David J. Peterson, it is not.
But when you use a real human language, that has its own cultural implications a lot of the time. My aforementioned ling slash comp sci partner thinks that TV writers should use Icelandic a lot more because it sounds very unusual to English speakers without running into the problem of, quote, let's use Arabic because it sounds harsh and exotic, end quote, etc. And when you just make things up, you run the risk of them sounding very silly. Wow, Kat.
You just made the case, Kat, that when you just make things up, you run the risk of them sounding very silly, which is why people hire conlangers like David J. Peterson to make up something that sounds like a plausible effort, because you say it's a lot of effort, but it's so much more effort for actors to have to extemporize some realistic sounding fictional language and then for that to be consistent with what the other actors are doing. I think that's how Klingon started, and then they needed more of it for the show. So then they brought in Mark Cochran to develop it based on what the actors had done. But it was like quite challenging for the actors to have to deal with it before that. David J. Peterson was constructed languages for lots of fiction. He came on The Illusionist a few years ago to talk about making Dothraki and Valyrian for Game of Thrones. We were talking about how much history he constructs for the language, because you have to take into account a lot of things like the geography of a place, how that might have influenced the kinds of words people need or the kind of sounds they make. And then all these mistakes that are in language. Like, it's not consistent at all. Mm. Like, English is full of all these idiosyncrasies that don't really make sense. And he has to come up with that so that the language isn't unrealistically perfect. Mm. It's just incredible how much stuff you have to think about. So probably if in Kat's example, he's only had to come up with one or two lines, he's not going to figure out thousands of words for it and a whole grammatical system and a whole writing system and a whole etymology. But he said that in Game of Thrones' case, the producers had tried to make up some for the auditions and they were really disappointed with how silly it sounded. And if you're spending millions on production and on a set and costumes and stuff and you're inventing a world, it's so cheap to hire someone who constructs languages. People are really sensitive to this stuff if it sounds unreal. And some people get so into it as well that they then want to learn it. And if it doesn't work, they're like, wait a minute. Mm. But I would say about Icelandic, I don't think Icelandic is the solution at all. I think maybe your partner in linguistics chose it because it's spoken mostly by white people. So that's why they thought it doesn't have the problems of Arabic. And there's only like 300,000 Icelandic speakers and they have a pretty good standard of living. So they're not discriminated against like other speakers of other languages might be. But Icelandic is an endangered language. And maybe it doesn't want whatever associations it would get from the fictional universe it's being poured into. Like you say, it wouldn't have the same problems as using Arabic, but no language is neutral. Hmm.
Ah. Very interesting.
And then some people will recognize it because it is right. Similar to Scandinavian languages, and there's quite a lot of that in English as well. So maybe it wouldn't sound foreign enough. Maybe this is why they use Latin so much, actually, because you're not offending ancient Romans now.
Right. I guess I just never, like, I didn't know Klingon. I didn't know about the existence of Klingon. I didn't know, like, even when I knew the word Klingon, I didn't know until very recently that it was an actual language that was created by someone.
So many people learned it, that it had a life outside of the show. Mm-hmm. That was another thing David J. Peterson was a bit disappointed by. He hoped people would do that with the languages he made for Game of Thrones, but he said they didn't really. But it might have been because the audience was a bit older and a lot of kids liked learning Klingon.
But also, you can't really know what the lifespan of it will be. I mean, even if that isn't a thing right now, I feel like fandoms especially like evolve over time. So it could have its time.
That
David
is very
J.
true.
Peterson, don't get sad, okay? You might have your time.
Anything can happen.
I think he's all right. I think he may have just done the language for Dune or something like that. He's a very busy language constructor. Wow. I'm happy
for
him.
What an amazingly fascinating job.
Yeah. I think also you don't get into it expecting it to become a job. He's constructed like 50-odd languages, and I think the ones for Game of Thrones were maybe his 17th.
Wow.
Some people just love doing this.
I can understand why. Cool. Like, I couldn't do it myself, but it does sound so fascinating and satisfying to me.
Did you see the Netflix film, The Christmas Chronicles, where Kurt Russell plays Santa? Mm-mm. It came out a couple of years ago. Apparently he invented Eulish for that.
Wow.
The language of Santa Claus and the
Excellent.
Elves.
Excellent. Okay, well, I'll be watching that now. Eulish. What a fantastic name for the language.
Did stuff in Thor and Doctor Strange, Lovecraft's country, The Witcher.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Oh, hey. So is he just like the only guy out there making languages?
Well, you do Game
what?
Of Thrones. I feel like you're probably the first call for everybody else.
Yeah.
There's lots of people who love doing it, but I don't know how many of them get to do it for money and television.
Right. David J. Peterson just taking all the language work out there.
I have a couple of questions for you, actually, based on Britishisms I noticed. Spike says the word git, which is not a word I've ever heard an American say.
Oh.
What does it mean?
It's just an insult.
Like a fool?
A not so sweary that you'd have to remove it insult. They probably say it in Harry Potter.
Gotcha. Yeah, I feel like I've heard that before enough to be like, that's, you're saying something not nice. That's like all it does to my brain.
It's a little retro. I'm not sure whether the children of today are saying it, but you could probably get it into a show aimed at them without censorship.
If you're a child listening to this, please do your job and bring Git back, okay?
And the other thing was, in the pilot, Giles mentions Bovril, a product, as far as I know, not marketed in the US, which is a jar of beef extract. So
what does he say about it?
Well, he just says that he'd rather be at home with a cup of Bovril because people dilute it and drink it hot.
Like broth?
It's thicker. It's more viscous than broth.
I don't understand what it is.
I'll just cut in to explain. Bovril is a thick, very dark brown ooze that is intensely salty and savoury, and it comes in small, round, bulb-shaped jars with red lids. Its original name was Johnston's Fluid Beef, after its inventor, John Lawston Johnston, who was a Scottish butcher living in Canada when in 1871 he won a contract to supply canned beef products to Napoleon III's armies during the Franco-Prussian War. Now, what's more cannibal, portable, shelf-stable and quick to prepare than solid beef? Why, liquid beef! Johnston's Fluid Beef was born, and as a teenager the product was renamed Bovril, and it was a huge hit. Victorians loved swigging that beef. Armies, strongmen, the Pope and Ernest Shackleton's Antarctic team were on the beef. There was for a while a horse version, Chevril, a portmanteau. I'll get to the name Bovril in a moment, but the reason it caught my attention while watching the pilot of Buffy the Vampire Slayer is that Bovril is not easily available in the US. There are import restrictions on the product. So it was surprising to me that in the late 1990s, Bovril was sneaked into this very American show. Would any viewer in the USA have got this reference?
No, but maybe somebody in the writer's room felt like I'm feeling right now, like kind of horrified and fascinated and had just learned about it, so wanted to pop it in the script.
It's Joss. He's like an Anglophile. It's his favorite thing to wedge little bits of this stuff in.
He'd waltz into the writer's room with a flask full of hot beef drink.
One has answered my question about what they have extracted from the cow. You can't just say it's a cow extract. Is it like skin?
It's none of your business, Kristen.
It's honestly better not to know.
Is it blood?
I think it's like whatever is left over from the full cow, they will condense into a dark brown gloop and put it in a jar and...
No.
You can spread it on some toast, or you can up a chili or something.
What is with everyone on toast?
Beef it up a drink, your chili, okay.
Like a beefy tea. Know. It is basically an instant beef tea, because that was what they were always feeding to people.
Okay,
like
beef tea.
Instant beef tea.
I mean, to me, it just sounds like if you have a chicken and you have the chicken carcass, you throw it in some water and you cook it for a long time and then you get broth. So like, is that they're just doing that, but with a cow?
It's much more intense, Kristen. It's much more intense.
All right. I'll let it go.
Oh, in about 2004, they took the beef out of Bovril and it was briefly vegetarian. And then a couple of years later, they beefed it again.
The rebeefening.
Rebeef.
You know what? I'm just going to stop
electric
asking questions.
Electric beefaloo.
It's clear to me that I need to stop asking questions.
Kristen didn't ask. Nonetheless, I must talk about the etymology of Bovril. The bov is like bovine here, from the Latin for cow. The vril is from science fiction, from Edward Bulwer Lytton's 1871 hit novel The Coming Race, wherein a superior race called the Vrilya derive strength, nourishment and healing from a fluid called vril. So Bovril means bovine power fluid.
Wow.
So it's like beefy life force.
Okay, so when I said, what were they sucking out of the cow, you actually had the answer the whole time.
It's the cow's soul
in
the jar.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Oh, shit.
The Illusionist is an independent podcast, and guess what? So is Buffering the Vampire Slayer, and they're currently hurtling towards their grand finale, having recapped nearly the entirety of 7 seasons of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And Jenny has written and performed a song for every single episode of the TV show. You can hear the podcast and the songs, and you can buy tickets for their upcoming live or live-streamed finale performances in New York City at bufferingthevampireslayer.com. This episode was originally produced by Kristin Russo for Buffering the Vampire Slayer, and there's actually more of it if you want. You can hear the full version, nearly twice the length, in their pod feed by searching for Welcome to the Helen Mouth. Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is grilse, noun, a salmon that has returned to fresh water after a single winter at sea. Try using grilse in an email today. You can help out your old pal The Illusionist if you'd like to by recommending the show to someone who may be in the market for a language-related entertainment podcast. And for just $2 a month, you can patronize The Illusionist, and as well as supporting the existence of this podcast, you get behind-the-scenes glimpses into the making of the show, perks like special merch at the live events, and a Discord community to chat with your peers about books and bats and beats, and whether stormtroopers' helmets smell. Join us, go to patreon.com/illusionist. The Illusionist music is by Martin Austwick of palebirdmusic.com and the podcast Neutrino Watch. Our ad partner is Multitude. To sponsor an episode of the show, contact them at multitude.production/ads. Find me at Illusionist Show on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram, and find every episode of the podcast in audio and transcript form, plus extra information about the topics in the episodes and the full dictionary entries for the randomly selected words at the show's forever home, theillusionist.org.